I'm glad you tuned in for another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word. Let's turn our attention back to the cliffhanger portion of our story of Samson, as recorded in the book of Judges, chapter 16. We'll roll back and resume our cliffhanger at verse 23. You know the story up to this point. Samson, in the 20th year of his leadership as judge, meaning he's got to be somewhere around 40, has been tricked by his girlfriend, Delilah, into betraying what he believed was the secret of his supernatural strength, his long, uncut hair. His hair gets cut, and he gets captured. His eyes are gouged out, so he'll never see another thing in his life. And he is turned into a work animal, grinding out the grain in the detention center there in Gaza. At some point, he seems to come to himself and realize that he overstepped his relationship with God by betraying the secret of his strength, by betraying his Nazarite vow. And his hair begins to grow back, and he apparently rededicates himself in the process of that hair growing back to finish his judgeship as best he can. The time of year, I think, is probably in the summertime, based on how I tie this into some chronology related to Samuel later. And we know that the later summertime is the harvest festivals. And I think that the Philistines may have had a regular harvest festival for themselves, just like the Israelis had their Feast of Tabernacles. And this year is going to be a special year. And this is how it's described, verse 23. Now, the lords of the Philistines, remember there are five of them because there are five city-states in the Philistine area, gathered to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. Now, Dagon is a very ancient Middle Eastern god. He seems to have the role of the father of the gods. He's like really high up there in the hierarchy of the Middle Eastern gods. The Philistines apparently have adopted him as their god whenever they've developed their culture here on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, the lower eastern coast of the Mediterranean basin. And so they want to say thank you to Dagon, not just simply for providing them a great harvest, I think, but also for this. They said, our God has given Samson, our enemy, into our hand. Because for 20 years, he's been really a moving roadblock to getting the most out of the Israelis by oppression. And now he's in their custody, blinded, and being like an ox or a donkey in grinding grain. For they said, our God has given our enemy under our hand, the ravager of our country who's killed many of us. So he'd apparently made incursions into Philistine territory, which is actually Israeli territory when you get down to the technicality of it. And so he has killed a lot of Philistines in the process, and they're upset about that. So he's Philistia's most wanted. And so when their hearts were merry, so I'm sure there's a lot of wine drinking going on here and a lot of music and singing and dancing. They said, call Samson that he may entertain us. So they are in the Dagon temple at Gaza. As I mentioned last session, we don't have any archaeological ruins of the Dagon temples of Philistia. So we don't know how big they were. We don't know what they look like, other than the hints we have from this story here. But the hint seems to be that it is a building that has a central open area that allows people on the upper deck to see things happening down in the main lower area. And so they say, call Samson that he may entertain us. So they called Samson out of the prison, so out of the detention center that's probably not too far away. And so he entertained them. How did he entertain them? Maybe they just simply sent people in to fight him. And more than likely, they would send people that would highlight the fact that he is helpless. So maybe short people, women, kids, you know, anybody that would be a non-combatant, somebody that would not normally be involved in a fight against a warrior of another country. Maybe they send some little animals after him, you know, little pets. You can use your imagination how they mocked him. But everybody got a good laugh out of it. Then we need a little break. So they made him stand between the pillars. Now, we've got an upper deck. We know about that. And so there would have been a series of pillars around whatever this open area is in the center of the complex. And they would have had multiple pillars holding up the cross beams, the cross pieces that hold up the front of that upper deck. And these pillars are apparently fairly close. We don't know what they're made of. We know that some places in the Middle East use natural logs, trunks of trees as their pillars. And so it could be that we're looking at that being the case here. But whatever it is, these pillars are bearing the weight from the upper deck, at least a portion of the upper deck. So they made him stand between these pillars as a break between sessions of mocking him. And Samson said to the young man who held him by the hand, some younger person is guiding him here and there because Samson can't see. He's blind. Let me feel the pillars on which the house rests that I may lean against them. So his request is, please, let me just catch my breath by leaning against something sturdy like the pillars of this complex. And the young person lets him do that. And then this is where we ended last session. Let me explain my thinking in my estimation that I gave you. Now, the house was full of men and women. So this is jam-packed. Everybody wants to come and make fun of Samson. And so all the lords of the Philistines were there. So all five of the leaders of the five city-states are there. And on the roof, that's the upper deck, there were 3,000 men and women. So there's at least 3,000 up above on the upper deck, and probably even more immediately under that deck because, you know, the deck probably is slanted up above, you know, tiered in order to give everybody a good view down into the center of the opening. And then there's probably room for people to crowd in in the open area as well, to be able to see Samson up close and personal. So if there's 3,000 up above, I think we could have upwards of 10,000 in the whole complex. And they looked on while Samson entertained, while he's doing all his stuff. And that's when Samson called on He Who Is and said, "Oh, He Who Is God, please remember me. Please strengthen me only this once, O God, that I may be avenged on the Philistines for my two eyes." So even at this late state, Samson is still wanting to get even and do this tit-for-tat thing. They took his eyes. He wants to take them out. But God is willing to give him his request because this is the mechanism by which God will begin the breaking of the Philistines that Samuel will finish, terminating their strength for a good period of time. And so Samson grasped the two middle pillars on which the house rested. And so that tells you that they're less than 6 feet apart. If he's able to reach out and touch each pillar, that means they're less than 6 feet apart. And when it talks about him grasping them, it almost sounds like they're smaller in diameter. So he's able to get his fingers around it, a little bit, not fully around it, but a little bit around it to get a good grip on the curve of these pillars. And he leaned his weight against them, his right hand on the one and his left hand on the other. And then Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." So he knows this is going to kill him, and he's good with that. So he bowed with all his strength, and the house fell upon the lords and upon all the people who were in it. Again, we do not know how this complex was arranged, but it would seem that the architecture was done in such a way that the catastrophic failure of these two pillars and the support above them, the things that they supported above them, started a cascading failure around the perimeter of that opening. And it brings the entire upper deck down. And so the people below it get crushed, and the people from above in the collapse, they are killed from the impact and all of the debris moving around because of this catastrophic failure of the building. And the writer of Judges tells us that the dead whom he killed in his death were more than those he had killed during his life. So if I'm correct in my assumption that he may have gotten up to 10,000 in this day, then it's a doubling at least of his lifetime Philistine death number. And so, verse 31, his brothers and all his family came down, because they're up in Danite territory on the River Sorek at Zora. And so they come down to Gaza after they hear about this great disaster, this collapse of the Dagon temple because of him. And they dig his body out. His brothers and all his family came down. They took him. And you know how it is after a disaster. Everybody's there, either trying to rescue people that are trapped in the debris or to at least recover the bodies so that they can give the people decent burials. So the Philistines are represented from all over their territory that day in the collapse. Many people had relatives die. So everybody from all over Philistia, they're there digging out bodies. And so a few Israelis, few Danites coming down are not going to really be noticed that much. So they dig him out, and then they brought him up, and they buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the tomb of Manoah, his father. Seems that dad is dead by now, but they bury him with respect and honor. And he had judged Israel 20 years. So now I want you to go to 1 Samuel chapter number 4, because I think this is chronologically related to what we just read. So in 1 Samuel chapter 4, we have kind of the finish of what was mentioned at the end of chapter number 3. Remember, chapters and verses do not exist in the original text. They are not part of the inspiration of the Word of God. They were added later by people trying to help us out. And so verse 20 of chapter 3 says, "All Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established as a prophet of He Who Is." So they knew that Samuel was God's new spokesperson there at Shiloh. "And He Who Is appeared again at Shiloh, for He Who Is revealed Himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of He Who Is." For the past 20 years, actually more than that, because Samuel started when he was probably a teenager, being a prophet. But through the entirety of Samson's judgeship, Samuel has been acting as God's prophet at Shiloh. Verse 1 of chapter 4 says, "And the word of Samuel came to all Israel." So Samuel is in the thick of things at Shiloh, where the tabernacle is located. Next part. "Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines." Now, why are they going out to battle against the Philistines? It's because the Philistines were coming after Shiloh. It says here that they, meaning the Israelis, encamped at Ebenezer, which it'll get that name later, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. Now, when you get a good map of this time period of Israel, this is what you'll find out. The Philistines had marched northward from their main territory of the five cities, a good day's travel, and then turned eastward and encamped at this place called Aphek. Aphek is the entry point into the hill country in which Shiloh is located. And so these Philistines are actually heading for the tabernacle. Why? This is my suspicion. This is my thesis. They have just had their Dagon temple at Gaza demolished by the Israeli Samson, and they are going to get even. If the Israeli hero Samson has taken out their temple, the temple of their God, they'll take out that temple of Israel. And so I believe that they are after Shiloh, and that's why they're at Aphek. And the Israelis realize that, and so they muster up the militia to try to stop this incursion into the hill country where Shiloh is located. Verse 2, "The Philistines drew up in line against Israel. When the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. Now, I don't know how long this was after the Gaza demolished, the temple at Gaza was demolished by Samson's death, but I think it's not very long. And the Philistines are still angry. They are on a revenge tour here. And so they kill only a portion of what they just lost in the collapse of the Dagon temple. They kill 4,000 Israeli militia members. But the militia of Israel realizes they're in a mess. If you lose that many people in one engagement, you got a problem. So verse number 3, when the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel, so we're talking about the leaders of each of the tribes that are mustering up individuals to come and defend the tabernacle. The Israel elders said, "Why has he who has defeated us today before the Philistines?" So they can't believe that God would be allowing this. Why were they being killed in such large numbers? And so they make a recommendation as leaders. Let us bring the ark of the covenant of he who is here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies. So they say, you know what we really need? We need God to come on his battle throne down to the front lines. The Israelis are going to treat the Ark of the Covenant as if it is an idol. In the ancient world, it was quite common to believe that an idol was the earthly center of a divine being's power base. And so the closer that idol was to a place, the more power that divine being could exercise. And so they decide to bring God to the front lines. That's their idea. Didn't ask for God's permission, they just did it. So the people sent to Shiloh. They brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of He Who Is of the Hosts. This is Yahweh Tzabaoth. This is God's military title. We're going to see it a lot more often now that we're moving into the kingdom period, because it is exceptionally common. Who is enthroned on the Kerubim. Remember that the Ark of the Covenant is not a decorated storage box. It is a portable throne. You've got the two Kerubim at either end, the far end of this elongated box. And those Kerubim have their wings going up and over the place where God is pictured as being seated on his throne. And so the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. So they are escorting the Ark. Now, their dad is not there because he is physically incapable of acting as high priest. He is high priest emeritus, if you will. These two guys, who are probably in their 60s or 70s, because their dad is in his upper 90s. He's like 98 when this story takes place. They're acting as the high priests of the Israelis, hands-on high priests. And so they are making sure that the Ark of God gets to the battle line. As soon as the Ark of the Covenant of He Who Is came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded. So they're excited, they're happy, because they believe God is in the camp with them now. When the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, "What does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And when they learned that the Ark of He Who Is had come to the camp, the Philistines were afraid for they said, a god has come into the camp. And actually, the Philistines have functioned a long time on this idea that the power base of an idol, a power base of a divine being, is centered on its idol. I wouldn't be a bit surprised that some image of Dagon is in their camp. But it scares them that the Israelis now have their power piece in their camp. Because guess what? They're a lot closer to Shiloh than they are to Philistine territory. So they're in enemy territory. They're in the territory where this God has much more power. That's the way they're going to be thinking. And so they said, woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us. Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? Now, they use the plural because the Israeli word for God is often in the plural. Even though he who is a singular deity, that doesn't compute for Philistines who are polytheists. They think of a multitude of gods. So they're thinking of multiple gods for the Israelis. These are the gods that struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. So they know their history. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight. So the Philistine response is not to retreat, but to basically pump up the soldiers, pump up their fighters with this, if we don't win here, all is lost. And I'm guessing that they're also stinging still from the loss of the Gaza temple. And they realize they don't want to be the underdogs when this is all done, because the Israelis will turn them into slaves and workers. And that just can't be allowed.